Sarah Rourke listened.
The Chinese are not coming. We cannot get out of here. The Russians control more of the first city than we suspected. Only six of us, including Frau Rourke and myself, are fit to go on. Our only hope is to find the chairman and free him, and then, to borrow an expression the Rourke family has used a time or two, pray. We pray that the chairman can somehow marshal his people to repulse the invaders. Otherwise, not only is the first city doomed, but so are we all. I cannot leave our injured unattended. I want two volunteers to stay with them. There is no cowardice in volunteering to stay behind. Perhaps it is the braver act than going forward. We at least will have mobility. Two volunteers, and this god they speak of. May he go with you.
Mueller and I will stay.
The younger volunteer looked barely old enough to shave. Sarah Rourke looked at Wolfgang Mann's face, then at the faces of the other two men, Reimann Schneider and Frank.
Divide up the ammunition evenly among us. One-third to those who stay behind, two-thirds to those who go on. If we survive, and are able, we shall return. If we are too late, your families will know. And...
Wolfgang Mann smiled, a smile she had never seen on his face before.
If somehow you should survive and we do not, then tell our families. Tell them that we tried. And that no matter what happens, the freedom we have won after so long shall not be sacrificed.
Then Wolfgang Mann did something which thoroughly frightened Sarah Rourke. He went to Mueller, took out his cigarette case, and handed it to the commando. She thought she heard him whisper something to Mueller about Frau Mann. Sarah Rourke's eyes welled up with tears. Soviet gunships were everywhere now, and Annie Rourke Rubinstein wanted to scream, but Natalia Tyomarovna still slept, her eyelids moved, the dreaming, the madness unending.
I have fired my last missile, Annie!
In desperation, they had flown toward Lushun, fuel running low, the weapon systems nearly depleted, the first city surrounded by Soviet gunships. In Annie's pocket, she carried something from her father.
If you're near the sea, and there are no other options, then open the cover, flip the toggle switch, and pray a lot.
He had then kissed her and hugged her harder than he had since she was a little girl. It was before they boarded the specials to go out and search for Michael. Now she understood what it was that he had given to her. Their liberated Soviet gunship shuddered.
We have been hit, Annie!
She fought back her tears. More calmly than she thought her voice could sound, she called forward to him.
Otto! Ditch in the sea! In the open sea!
What?
She had seen the place from which the signaling device came when all of them went there for the special medical examinations. But it was still like a dream. Submarines. An America of Americans of all colors and religions who fought the same war against different Soviet enemies. Annie looked at Natalia. She had already put Natalia into a life vest. Perhaps it was all fate. Fate that they should come here. The very fabric of the machine creaked and twisted and shivered. Smoke filled the fuselage. Annie's eyes streamed tears.
We are going down!
Annie Rubinstein felt a certain feeling of peace. The rifles were damaged beyond use. Paul Rubinstein's right hand and arm were burned, and the fingers of his right hand did not close properly. The muscles of John Rourke's chest and shoulder seemed to cry out to him each time he moved, cry out for him to rest. They walked ahead, the Detonic Scoremaster 45s in Rourke's fists, Paul's left fist clenched on the pistol grip of the submachine gun he still called a Schmeisser. Whether or not either or both of them took a lethal dose of radiation, Rourke had no way of telling. Though the alarm went on without end, the two men were barely aware of it. There was only one purpose now. The meltdown was underway. It would be the last act of human folly. Rourke and Rubinstein did not speak of it as they walked. No words were necessary. Their sole purpose was to find the temple, or wherever it was the religious zealots of the Second City initiated the program, and stop it. If the program that began the meltdown was unstoppable, no other purpose mattered. All life would end.
You're the best friend I ever had, John.
Yeah. Brothers.
Yeah. Brothers.
Yes. Yes.
There had been a design for a safe fission reactor, but for low output in the 80 megawatt range and designed to be used in series with reactors of the same size. The program was geared to prevent meltdown. Meltdown at the least would take the core material down through the earth beneath the reactor and into the underground water table. Still, some theories held that a meltdown of sufficient size and heat would be unstoppable, punching through the earth from side to side. If such were possible, a reactor complex of the size that powered the second Chinese city could do it. They at last reached the end of the plexiglass wall. There were metal stairs winding upward in a spiral toward a set of double doors, also of metal, these located some 100 or so feet above the floor.
Oh, that's just what I needed. Steps.
John Rourke looked at his friend for a moment.
Yeah, stairs, actually. The general syntactical rule of thumb is that the steps are on the outside of a structure and the stairs are on the inside.
Thanks, Mr. Webster. Either way, they're just as hard to climb.
Ain't it the truth?
The 45s dangled in Rourke's hands. Every muscle in his body ached, and he imagined it was worse for Paul following behind him. The electricity began again, sparking along the metal framework for the wall of plexiglass, uncomfortably close considering what had happened, but of no danger to them now. Rourke imagined there was some sort of irregular time schedule, all part of the master program that ran the facility, a defense system for the reactor complex. Perhaps some of the burns endured by the bear they fought were the result of being too close to the plexiglass wall when the electrical charges arced. But the major disfigurement was still something Rourke put down to intentional mutilation. A third of the way up the stairs, Paul slumped.
Can we rest a minute?
Rourke nodded. They sat on the stairs. Rourke considered the stairs might periodically electrify, but since they were the only way up and neither of them was in shape for a marathon, he accepted the calculated risk. The rubber treads, largely rotted away, supported his theory that they were safe.
What do we do when we get there?
Rourke looked down at the younger man.
Bluff our way through. Or maybe Maria can do something with the computer once we gain access to the program. If we can find Maria, and if we can find the computer, and if we can access the program. Hell, I don't know. I'm not Mr. Wizard. I'm just Mr. Webster.
Paul Rubenstein looked up at him and smiled.
Well, we'll do the best we can then, huh? Which, I suppose...
Yeah, right.
Rourke, his back spasming with pain, stood. Paul grabbed the railing and stood as well. They trudged upward again as the electrical display wound down. At the top of the stairs, the door seemed more massive close up than they had from the base. Rourke and Rubenstein stood before them, assessing them.
Could be electrified. Once bitten, twice shy.
It's probably not an alarm unless this is some taboo area. That wouldn't make sense because our Mongol friends outside had to have come this way since there doesn't appear to be any other way. They came from the outside. Even then, somebody had to get down here with the sacrifices for the bear. The hinges aren't lubricated, but they aren't as corroded as much of the rest of the metal either. That indicates they're opened and closed with some regularity. They may be locked from the other side, however.
John Rourke tried the metal doors first by touching the muzzle of one of the scoremasters against it to test for electrical shock. His hand only in contact with the rubber Packmeyer grips. No shocks.
So far, so good.
He rammed both pistols into his gun belt and put his hands to the door handles. They twisted. The doors gave slightly toward him, but did not open.
I bet they have a simple brace on the other side of the doors. Just a cross piece.
Rourke dropped to his knees. His muscles screamed in protest. He carefully inspected the seam where the doors met. There was a large rubber gasket on each door, but the gaskets were seriously frayed. Rourke drew the grain knife from its sheath and gingerly inserted it between the doors. The rubber gasket fell away in chunks to the floor, some of the chunks powdered. With patience, he got the grain knife's 12-inch blade between the doors, well below the handles. He scratched the knife a bit, but it couldn't be helped. Slowly, he raised the knife until the sawtoothed spine of the blade encountered something solid. Rourke got up into a crouch, his back muscles locking up. He stood, waited a moment until the pain subsided a bit, then crouched again, this time more carefully. Steadily, he began to raise the knife, both fists molded to the handle, pushing upward, he hoped, on the crosspiece. There was a sudden increase of pressure, but only for an instant, then the pressure eased. Rourke eased his knife from between the doors. It was a little scratched, but otherwise undamaged. He sheathed the knife. Paul stood ready with a submachine gun in his left hand. Rourke drew both doors open and stepped back. He snatched the two scoremasters from his belt, thumbs jacking back the hammers. A piece of wood about 4x4 in thickness and 3 feet or so in length lay on the floor. The doors opened to a long corridor. The corridor was well lit, and about midway along its length, they saw ornamental murals and lamps.
The back door of the temple?
The back door of the temple.
They pulled the door shut and replaced the wooden crosspiece. If someone were behind them, John and Paul would hear the crosspiece fall for some distance.
You ready?
Yeah.
They moved on, Rourke again carrying a Detonic Scoremaster 45 in each fist. To be deaf was maddening. Michael Rourke could see Maria Lloyden, see her mouth opening and closing as she screamed, but he could not hear her. Han Lu Chen was shackled to the far wall, not bound to opposite sides of the massive altar, as were Michael and Maria. And Han was being beaten across the back with a wide strap by the black-garbed executioner Michael saw in the dungeons. On the floor between the altar and where Han Lu Chen was being whipped, the unconscious body of Vasily Prokopyev lay, discarded as though it were a child's doll no longer found amusing. The back of Prokopyev's head was bloodied. Perhaps the sheer force of the sound drove the Elite Corps commander to madness, or perhaps despair that all was lost when the chamber through which they passed proved to be a malevolent trap. Strange feelings, Michael realized, but he respected the man and knew that under more normal circumstances, Vasily would never have fired a weapon in such a noise-expanding passageway. The High Priestess, or whatever she was, had a look of beautiful evil. She moved across the temple room with consummate grace. In her long robes, she seemed to float rather than walk. At the far wall of the temple, young women in white dresses paid obeisance to a ballistic missile. Michael's stomach knotted. Like a separate altar before the missile stood the largest computer console Michael Rourke had ever seen. It looked like the controls for one of the old mainframe computers he'd seen in the occasional movie from his father's videotape collection at the retreat. Another of the beautiful women would adjust the setting of a dial every few moments, depress a button, flip a toggle switch. Maria was right. They worshipped nuclear death here. As Michael looked around the room, he realized his hearing was returning. He first realized he could hear again when, after a very long time, the woman who was the head priestess or whatever came to him and raised her fingernails over his face. Like cats he had seen in videotapes, claws distended, about to scratch him.
Michael!
The woman turned away, and Michael Rourke saw Vasily Prokopyev, whom he had thought was dead. Prokopyev's face was covered with blood as well. Prokopyev had gotten to his feet and snapped his left elbow up into the face of one of the Mongol guards. The room was full of them. Prokopyev grabbed the guard's Glock 17 pistol and shot the guard twice in the face, then shot the priestess, or whoever she was. The woman fell to the floor. Prokopyev took one of the Mongol swords, and as he started to collapse, he hacked down with the sword, severing the rope binding Michael's left hand. John Rourke positioned both Detonic Scoremasters in his pistol belt. The 45s were cocked and locked. At the end of the long corridor, with its wall murals depicting the night of the war, the great conflagration, and other violent themes, stood two large, ornately carved, black-lacquered wooden doors. Their trim appeared to be real gold. Rourke tried the heavy doors, and they opened easily under his hands. Michael Rourke grabbed the Glock 17 pistol in his left hand as it fell from Prokopyev's hand. Michael's fingers were stiff and moved with difficulty, but he was able to aim at a charging Mongol and pull the trigger. He grabbed the Mongol's saber, twisted right, hacked the rope holding his right hand, and sat up. His head swam as he hacked away the ropes holding his feet. A third Mongol rushed him, and as the saber crashed on the stone altar, Michael Rourke tumbled from the altar, hitting the floor hard. The stone floor was cold to his naked body. Paul Rubinstein twisted his body weight left, throwing his already injured right arm against the doors, figuring he had nothing to lose. As the doors burst inward, John Rourke stepped through. Both Scoremaster 45s came to John Rourke's hands like living creatures answering a call. Paul Rubinstein felt excruciating pain in his right arm and rammed the Schmeisser forward, taut against its sling. Mongol guards went down. Women in long white dresses, who looked as if they were late for some sort of prom, rushed across the temple and brandished torches. It was shoot at the women or burn. They fired into the temple ceiling. Some of them fell back. John laced one of the women across the jaw with his fist, a pistol still clenched in it as he dodged a torch. The naked Maria Lloyden was lashed to some sort of pagan altar. One of the prom girls came toward her in a dead run, stabbing a torch toward her face.
John!
Paul swung the Schmeisser on line with the torchbearer's chest. Paul looked left. Michael stood, stark naked, smoke trailing from the Chinese Glock 17 pistol in his left hand. As Michael stood there for an instant, two Mongols charged him, guns and sabers drawn.
Paul, get him!
doors on the far side of the temple burst open. More Mongols streamed through. Rourke rammed both empty 45s into his pistol belt, drew the 629, and fired from the hip like some sort of Western gunfighter. Michael Rourke passed like a blur across Paul's field of vision as Paul pulled the Browning. Though two Mongols fell, more swept into the room. Rourke and Rubenstein turned their full firepower on the rushing horde. A man all in black rushed forward, lashing out with a wide strap, half like a whip, half like a belt. John's left shoulder took the lash as he tried to turn. Paul Rubenstein spun and raised the Browning. The black-robed man stumbled to his knees, dropped the whip, and tumbled forward. One of the temple maidens in white hacked toward John's face with a torch. John stepped back and brought the little 45 Detonics in his left hand to bear. John and Michael Rourke and Paul Rubenstein arrayed themselves in a skirmish line. Michael, still naked, looked at once ludicrous and deadly. Wheeled toward the screaming Maria. She was still bound at the opposite end of the altar. A Mongol with a torch rushed down on her. Paul aimed, and as he fired, he heard almost simultaneous shots from beside him. The Mongol's body jerked, spun, and twisted. Flowers of blood bloomed at the Mongol's forehead, his throat, and his right cheek. Paul turned quickly back toward the doors through which the additional Mongol mercenaries had come. No movement, except for a few of the Chinese women in their prom-like dresses who ran toward the corridor beyond.
Paul! Help me close those doors!
Michael ran to the door.
I bring Maria! Oh my God!
Paul looked back as he threw his weight to one of the double doors and Michael pushed the other door. The doors were 12 feet high at least, but moved easily enough. As Paul closed the door, he surveyed the room behind him and saw John freeing Han Lu Chen of chains that bound him to the black marble wall nearest the altar. Han's body was striped by the whip, almost unrecognizable as human. Paul scanned the room for a brace to keep the door shut.
Paul, here!
Michael Rourke tugged at a mighty metal bar, resting along the joint between floor and wall on the far side from where Paul stood. It looked to be at least 8 by 8 inches and as many feet in length. Paul ran to him, bent to the bar, tried lifting it. Without warning, John Rourke was beside them at the center of the bar.
Ready? Lift!
The bar was up, and they guided it toward the doors, raising it still higher to drop it into the cleats on the door.
Han's in desperate shape, but we're in war shape if we don't stop that meltdown.
What meltdown?
Paul couldn't understand why Michael was shouting until he noticed the bloodstains beneath Michael's left ear, and as Michael turned his head, a similar blood trail under his right ear and along his neck and onto his chest.
A series of nuclear reactors! Reactors! A bunch of them! Could screw up everything! Boom!
Paul gestured outward with both hands, and his right arm seized with pain.
Right!
Vasily Prokopyev was on the floor, seriously wounded as well. Michael dropped to his knees beside him.
Paul, cut Maria loose!
Paul finished reloading the Schmeisser, started to speak, only nodded and drew the Gerber. As he moved to the altar to cut Maria loose, his thoughts turned to Annie. Annie Rubenstein clung to the outside of the life raft, but the raft was going down. One of the Soviet gunships strafed the raft, wounded Otto Hammerschmidt, then flew away, leaving them to die in the water. The partially deflated raft could barely hold Otto and Natalia well enough to keep their unconscious forms sufficiently above water to be able to breathe. Annie clung to the outside, hanging in the water to reduce the downward pressure on the leaking raft. She activated the signaling device her father gave her the moment their stolen Soviet gunship splashed into the calm surface of the Yellow Sea. No one was coming.
We need you, damn it! Help us!
No one was coming. Sarah Rourke had found a place to relieve herself. She felt better now.
Sorry.
For what are you sorry, Sarah?
I mean, holding you guys up.
Colonel Mann smiled that very nice, very sincere smile of his.
You have nothing to feel sorry about. If I had at my disposal 100 commandos, with your courage and skill, no enemy of freedom would ever stand before me and survive.
You're very nice.
It sounded lame to her as she said it, but it was the only thing she could think of to say. Mann smiled again, saying nothing. With the two remaining commandos, they'd set out again. This was familiar terrain to Sarah, the lower levels of the government building where presumably the chairman of the First City was being held prisoner. She hoped he still lived, prayed that he did, because the chairman was now their only hope. There were three sentries near the entrance she selected, a service access, and using silenced pistols, they easily dispatched them. It was then, after entering through the service access, she found a bathroom and used it. Something was making her stomach very queasy. She kept telling herself it was the baby. They walked along the corridor toward the service elevators now. The feeling of unease grew in her. They passed a storage room and approached an elevator bank.
Inside here, it's a feeling.
Follow Frau Rock, hurry!
She passed through a doorless doorway quickly, flattening herself against a stack of crates just inside the opening. Mann and the others followed.
This way, comrades!
Through the opening, she could see men moving in black battle dress utilities, Soviet assault rifles in hand. In their midst was a man dressed in the uniform of an elite corps colonel. For one split second, she caught his face in profile. It had to be. Sarah Rourke loosed her rifle and drew the Trapper Scorpion 45.
Back me up, but only when I say to.
She felt Mann's hand reach for her, but she slipped out of his grasp and stepped out of hiding. Sarah Rourke dodged between two KGB elite corpsmen carrying assault rifles slung at patrolling positions. She stabbed the muzzle of her 45 against the face of the man in the colonel's uniform, praying it was Antonovich, the new commander.
Freeze!
She thumbed back the Trapper Scorpion's hammer to full stand. The squad of soldiers pointed rifle muzzles at her from all sides. If Mann would only trust her as much as he said he did, her left hand was knotted into the back collar of the colonel's uniform blouse. For an instant, no one moved.
Tell him I'm a Rourke and I'll kill you, so help me God.
What can you hope to gain, Mrs. Rourke?
Sweat glistened on his forehead.
Tell them!
She pushed the muzzle harder against his cheek, drawing the pistol back, then just a little because she remembered something John had told her. A Colt Browning Pattern 45 wouldn't fire with firm backward pressure against the muzzle because it pushed the slide out of battery. It had to be Antonovich. She prayed it was Antonovich. There was a blur of movement from the entryway to the storage room. Colonel Mann and his two commandos stepped out, rifles rising to assault position, getting the drop on the dozen or so KGB elite corpsmen.
What do you...
Shut the hell up! You do exactly as I say, or this gun goes off, and you know what a 45 will do at this range. Colonel Mann?
Yes, Frau General?
She almost started to laugh.
Disarm these guys, and if anybody gives you any lip, Antonovich here gets it. Tell your people. Tell them!
Lay down your arms.
Quickly then, Colonel Mann and his two commandos began stripping the Russians of their weapons, tossing rifles, pistols, individual explosives, knives, all into the storage room.
Now, out of their uniforms and boots, down to their underwear. People don't fight so well without their pants.
Antonovich smiled a little thinly. She gave him credit. He had guts.
What if they aren't wearing underwear, Mrs. Rourke?
It's nothing I haven't seen before. Tell them to strip. Now!
Remove your uniforms and boots.
Quickly, but with obvious reluctance, the elite corpsman began to undress. She was almost surprised they didn't wear black underwear.
Throw the uniforms in the storage room.
No, get one of them to help you. All the guns and other stuff into the elevator. That's where we're going.
There are troops up there.
Panic filled the Soviet colonel's eyes.
Good. And the chairman?
He didn't answer her.
And the chairman?
Yes.
Good. My God, I've got to go again.
Maria Lloyden sat at the computer console.
I can't read Chinese. It won't do me any good.
Across the temple, John Rourke searched his musette bag in vain for something that would revive Han Lu Chen.
Michael!
Michael Rourke was tending to Prokopyev's wounds with materials from Rourke's musette bag. The Russian was sitting up, very weak, but as likely to live as any of them.
Michael! Did you bring a first aid kit from one of the special?
Yes, there are enough
bring
of
them. Bring it over here where Paul's tending to Han!
Rourke left Maria Lloyden and ran across the temple toward where Paul was using the German antiseptic healing spray on Han Lu Chen's back. John Rourke dropped to his knees beside the man, his own back spasming with pain.
Ah! Son of a bitch!
Rourke took the first aid kit Michael carried and searched for the pre-prepared syringe of synthetic adrenaline. He could kill Han Lu Chen by injecting it directly into the heart, but if he didn't risk the Chinese agent's life, then the whole world might die.
All right, turn him over and hold him down. If I don't do this right, he's dead and so are we.
Rourke prepared the syringe.
Oh, if only Michael were here. He's such a strong swimmer.
They drifted miles from shore.
I shouldn't have told Otto to ditch in the water. We should have taken our chances with the Russians overland. Help us!
The raft was so deflated now that by treading water, she was barely able to hold up Natalia's and Otto's heads, keeping them out of the water. She had stripped away her heavy clothes and was only in her blouse and her underwear. Her pistols and Natalia's were suspended on their pistol belts over a still-floating piece of wreckage a few yards distant. The little cold steel Mini Tonto was still strapped to her ankle.
Help!
The signaling device was in the pocket of her blouse over her left breast. It probably didn't even work anymore after the prolonged exposure to salt water. Her father told her about the sharks when they traveled to Midway for the medical examinations. She actually saw one, at least she thought it was one, through the video monitors at the front of the submarine. But none of the friends her father made were there, except the cute little nurse who told her that her father was so stubborn, and of course Midway's president, Hansel, and such a wonderful voice. But none of the others were there. They were all off in their submarines fighting the Russians, or whatever they did. Suddenly, Annie Rourke Rubenstein was seized with panic. What if the signal had worked, and instead of summoning help from Midway, it had summoned the Russians they fought beneath the sea? She looked around. The surface of the sea churned slightly, definitely less calm than it had been. What if... The raft was all but totally deflated, and she supported the weight of Natalia and Otto almost completely, her arms weary. What would she do when she could no longer support them both? How would she choose who was to die? But no help came. Sarah Rohr kept the .45 against Colonel Antonovich's temple as the elevator doors opened on the upper level of the government building where the chairman's apartment was located, along with the rooms she and her family used. In a strange way, it was like returning home.
You will never escape here alive.
Sarah pushed Antonovich out of the elevator and into the corridor. Wolfgang Mann and his two remaining commandos followed, weapons at the ready.
What happens to us happens to you.
KGB elite corpsman began running toward them along the main corridor.
This is where you decide to live or die. Tell them to lay down their arms and use the elevator. Then send it back for the next batch of your guys.
His men were closing rapidly.
You'll die first. I swear it.
Halt!
The elite corpsman slowed, stopped, waited, their rifles at high port, ready to swing online and fire.
After everybody's out of this building and Chinese troops have retaken this section of the city, after your men evacuate here and all the rest of the city, then withdraw beyond the mountains. You have my word as a Rourke that you'll be freed, unharmed, allowed to rejoin your men outside the city. We'll even give you free transportation.
She just realized she had never disarmed Antonovich of his pistol, but it was too late to try that now.
The German... He will listen to you?
I told him...
I heard what you told him, Sarah.
Wolfgang Mann looked directly at Antonovich.
I will honor Frau Rourke's pledge, Herr Colonel. You have my word as a German officer.
Antonovich started to say something and apparently thought better of it.
Bring out the chairman. And if somebody puts a gun to his head, you die.
This time it appears that you win. It is too bad that history has dictated that the Rourke family should be the intractable enemies of the Soviet people. Otherwise...
History didn't dictate anything. Men like Karamazov, just ordinary thieves and killers until you put uniforms on and tell yourselves you're heroes and what you're doing is for the good of some crazy historic destiny. Men like you made the choice. This time, you live, Colonel. Next time, who's to say? Bring out the chairman.
Put down your weapons and bring out the chairman.
An officer from among the corridor guards put down his rifle slowly at first, followed by the rest of the force. The officer and two other men disappeared along the corridor, and for a moment, Sarah forgot she had to urinate again because she thought that maybe Antonovich had some trick up his sleeve. The seconds seemed to wear on forever. One of Colonel Mann's commandos began offloading the Soviet weapons from the elevator, then began gathering up the weapons the guards put on the floor. Sarah's head ached. Her hand felt stiff holding the pistol so rigidly. Her knees were locking because Antonovich was taller than she was, and she had to stand as tall as she could to keep the gun at his head properly. Then, his robes mud-splattered, hair uncombed, the chairman of the First City emerged from his room. He glanced once to either side of him, and the Soviet guards left him. With his customary dignity, he walked alone down the corridor, past the Russian troops who had held him prisoner. He stopped before Sarah Rourke, bowed slightly, and smiled.
How good of you to come, Mrs. Rourke.
Sarah Rourke wanted to laugh and cry at once, but she held the pistol to Antonovich's head while his men started filling the elevators.
I hope those doors hold.
Han Lu Chen, Michael, and Paul, holding him up, leaned forward in the chair before the console.
That button on the keyboard. Try that button.
Maria Lloyden pushed the button and the monitor screen flickered. A mixture of Chinese symbols and English words appeared. Immediately, Maria began accessing the program. Vasily Prokopyev's voice came from behind them.
I apologize for killing the woman. It is likely she knew the program you seek to invade.
Likely.
Rourke didn't turn his head to look back.
Prokopyev?
Now Rourke did look back.
Yes, Dr. Rourke.
I noticed that this computer seems to be set up for guidance systems monitoring.
Prokopyev, his head bandaged heavily but face alert, leaned against the wall beside the doors. A brace of Glock pistols lay on the floor beside him. At mention of monitoring the missile while in flight, Prokopyev sat up straighter.
Would you and Paul be able to convert the monitoring system so you could contact your forces outside the city? Alert them to pull back in the event we can't stop this? Although, in honesty, that wouldn't do much good for him. Just buy him a few moments, perhaps, but...
Rourke followed Prokopyev's eyes as they moved upward along the length of the missile.
I could call down a gunship to land near the opening through which the missile would launch.
Yeah, you could, yeah. But I don't exactly relish the idea of getting killed by the KGB any more than dying here.
Certain death is always the poorer option.
Get Paul to help you. He's good with electronics. Then go call your friends. And I'm gonna need Paul as soon as you have it set up.
Rourke looked at Paul Rubenstein. There was an odd look in Paul's eyes.
I accessed a monitoring program. The missile will launch in 18 minutes. I don't think I can stop it.
What about the meltdown?
He sat beside her, as calmly as he could, fresh loading the magazines for his pistols.
I don't know yet.
Try that line with the character. That looks like a tree.
Maria began working the keyboard again. Annie Rourke sank below the surface. She realized instantly that she had passed out or fallen asleep. She forced her head above the water. She scanned the water for signs of Natalia or Otto. She held to the deflated life raft. She saw Otto, reached out to him. She dragged him back to the surface.
Natalia! Natalia!
Hands reached out from the foaming sea. Figures in black clothing and helmets rose to the surface. She almost lost her hold on Otto Hammerschmidt as she reached for her little knife, but a hand like a vice caught her wrist. The helmet of one of the figures surrounding her came off. The head ducked below the surface and reappeared all wet, curly hair matted over the man's forehead.
I'm Jason Darkwood, and you must be Annie Rubenstein, the 500-year-old man's daughter. Anybody else in the water?
He had a handsome face. She knew she was dead and this wasn't happening. Still, she went along with the dream.
Natalia?
The man who called himself Darkwood nodded and began talking again, but not to her.
Sebastian, how's Major Chemerovna? We got her? Good. Prepare the Regan to surface. Mark on our transponders. Put out a raft for us. In just another second here, repeat that last part to this charming young lady I just found. I suspect she'll be an interested listener.
The man with the flippant attitude and the pretty eyes passed over something to her that looked like an ordinary earplug, putting it beside her jawbone.
I have been instructed by Commander Darkwood to inform you that Major Chemerovna has been brought in by two of our divers who immediately administered a hemosponge so she would be able to breathe. We have every reason to believe that Lieutenant Commander Barrow will be able to pull Major Chemerovna through. Thank you.
She was holding the little thing against her jawbone and she dropped it. Darkwood fished the device out of the water. He pushed his hair back from his forehead.
You're the one my father talked about.
The smartass. That's me, I'm afraid.
Darkwood smiled at her, then held the little plug against his jawbone and spoke.
Lieutenant Stanhope, talk to me.
And he put his head beside hers with the earplug thing between them so that she could hear too.
Captain, this man's been seriously wounded, but I think he'll make it. Over.
Darkwood looked at her.
Hammerschmidt. Captain Otto Hammerschmidt. He's a German commando. He's my friend.
I know the name. Tom? That man's an officer with the forces of New Germany. Make sure he makes it. Darkwood out.
A massive black monolithic shape began to rise out of the water about 25 yards from them.
That's my submarine, the USS Reagan. You'll love it. Trust me.
Somehow, she did. In case what they planned worked, John and Michael Rourke placed the bodies of the remaining Maidens of the Sun down the corridor and beyond the steel doors leading to the staircase, just above the reactor room. They bound them with parts of their own clothing, but loosely enough that once they regained consciousness, they could eventually work themselves free. At least in this location, they would have a chance to survive the backblast of the missile launching. Prokopyev, with Paul's help, contacted the Soviet force outside the second city, established his identity, and ordered up a chopper with a volunteer crew. He then ordered the rest of the Soviet force to the mountains well away from the second city. John Rourke wished Natalia were there. But they still had a chance by combining Paul's and Michael's and Prokopyev's skills with his own, the barely conscious Han Lu Chen assisting Maria Lloyden as best he could while she worked the keyboard for the main portion of the computer. With considerable difficulty, Prokopyev and Michael climbed the gantry and worked with the onboard guidance system. It should be a matter of gyroscopic adjustment only, Rourke hoped. To attempt to sabotage the entire guidance system might only have the opposite effect and precipitate premature firing. John Rourke knelt beside Paul at the rear of the massive computer. Paul worked at rewiring the interior of the large machine.
What I hope I can do, and what Maria says might work, and what would be a hell of a lot easier if my right hand weren't so stiff, is to set this sucker up so we can key new guidance coordinates into the system. Maria said it, and she's right. There isn't any time to get into the memory and fool with it. I saw systems like this, hybrids, transitional types of computers. We can fool with the software like Maria's doing now, but we gotta make it talk to the other part of the system. Get a handshake, like they used to say.
6 minutes remained before launch, 6 minutes before the meltdown of the reactors would be beyond recall. It was a doomsday machine, crude but undeniably lethal to the future of the planet. The missile was programmed to launch and return to point of origin upon re-entry, the radioactive core material of the myriad reactors already punching through into the Earth as the missile struck. The largest, most deadly explosive device ever conceived.
How much time, John?
Just under 6 minutes.
Shit!
Rourke stood up, walked quickly to where Maria Lloyden was working the keyboard.
How's it going?
I think I've got a new coordinate set. I only hope we figured them right.
They had pulled up a master program of guidance coordinates and improvised. All that remained was to feed the new coordinates into the system.
So all I have to do is enter the coordinates and push this button. I think.
You start up the gantry.
What about Han?
Rourke looked at the Chinese, half unconscious now, head resting on the work surface before the master console.
I'll take care of Han, I promise.
She rose and they walked to the gantry.
Paul! Almost!
Almost! Maybe!
They stopped at the base of the gantry. John Rourke looked up.
Michael, how's it going?
We have realigned the gyroscopic and inertial navigational controls. We think.
Then get up by the hatch so you can get out as soon as the final firing sequence begins and the hatch opens. Maria's on the way.
What about you?
Don't worry.
He helped Maria to the gantry ladder, stayed there as she started up, then returned to Paul. Paul didn't look at him as he spoke.
This thing's either gonna work, or cook off all the wiring in the system. Fire the missile without altering the trajectory. So, how much time?
3.5 minutes.
Now what?
John Rourke reached out his right hand. Paul did the same. They clasped hands.
I mean, if this is it, had to be a real handshake.
Help me with Han.
I'm staying.
What about Annie?
She'd stay too. You never make it up without me with Han on your back. Who are you kidding?
John Rourke nodded, and their hands parted. Rourke quickly moved to the console and pointed to the keyboard.
She said to push this button!
Then I guess we'd better push it.
John Rourke smiled.
Then I guess I'll push it!
John Rourke pushed the button. Nothing happened. But what was supposed to happen? It was a gamble.
Help me with Han!
Paul slung his submachine gun behind his back, then helped John Rourke to get the injured Chinese into a standing position. Rourke bent forward, letting Han Lu Chen collapse over his left shoulder. Rourke stood there a moment, settling the man's weight as best he could. Then he looked at Paul.
Let's go!
Together, they started for the gantry.
You first, in case you need a push with that extra weight, huh?
Rourke nodded, put his left foot to the first rung, then started to climb. The missile, mere feet from them, began to vibrate noticeably. They kept climbing. Rourke glanced at his watch as he moved his left hand toward the next higher rung. Less than 2 minutes. Heat and exhaust climbed the gantry with the small band of weary fighters. 1 minute. The missile shook and the gantry ladder with it. 45 seconds. The hatch was open above them, the gray sky visible. Michael watched anxiously through the hatch. John Rourke wanted to shout up to him to get away, but Michael would not have gone. 30 seconds, and the very fabric of the mountain seemed to shake. If the reprogramming worked, the meltdown procedure was aborted, and the trajectory of the missile changed. 15 seconds. The missile started to lurch upward. Retaining cables on all sides of the missile snapped away. John Rourke reached upward toward the hatch. Michael's hands reached down. John Rourke could feel Paul pushing upward on Han's body. Michael pulled Han upward. There were other hands, black uniform blouses, KGB Elite Corps commandos. Rourke and Paul launched out of the hatch. A Soviet gunship was ready to lift off just a few yards from the open hatch at the top of the mountain. One of the Elite Corpsmen reached for John Rourke's guns. John Rourke's hands moved.
No time! To the gunship!
The mountain shook. Great clouds of noxious-smelling vapors issued from the hatchway. Rourke and Rubinstein and Prokofiev ran for the chopper on the heels of the Elite Corpsmen.
Lift off!
The gunship started to rise. John Rourke at its base. Paul clambered aboard. Rourke and Prokofiev jumped in together. The gunship slipped left across the mountaintop and started to climb. John Rourke crouched beside Maria Lloyd. Han Lu Chen's head was in her lap. Michael's arm was around her shoulders. Out of the silo came the missile. It hesitated against the gray sky, then rose, so enormous that it seemed incapable of flight.
Did you do it?
We aren't vaporized in
3.5 minutes!
Or if the center of the mountain doesn't seem to collapse, neither one happens. We did it!
The gunship, per Prokofiev's orders, hung back about a mile distant from the mountain of the second Chinese city. Wind and cold whipped at them, but John Rourke didn't think any of them cared. Rourke's eyes darted between the missile, visible through the open door in the fuselage, and the mountain. If their efforts worked, the meltdown would be halted and the process reversed. If it worked, the missile's trajectory had been altered enough so it would not re-enter, but arc back miles above the atmospheric shield and go off harmlessly into space. If. No gray-white streak passed between them an instant before blindingly brilliant light and oblivion. The center of the mountain did not collapse. John Rourke stood up. He slid the fuselage door closed.
Well, now what? I shall drop you off wherever you wish, within reason, and then face a court-martial.
Prokofiev smiled, extending his right hand. John Rourke took the hand. Rourke's thoughts were filled with concern for Natalia, that her mind would be restored, with concerns for his family, that someday they would find peace. And as he clasped Prokofiev's hand, this Russian who might be shot for his humanity despite his position as head of the Elite Corps, John Rourke thought also of hope and honor. Survivalist: The Ordeal is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1988, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Mort Shelby, Michael Glenn, Ren Casey, Nanette Savard, Eric Messner, M.B. Van Dorn, Stephen Carpenter, Tony Nam, David Coyne, Christopher Graybill, Elizabeth Jernigan, Jeff Baker, Michael John Casey, Dylan Lynch, Tom Simpson, Richard Rowan, and Ken Jackson. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Timothy Lynch. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Greg Reinfeld. Adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for Ryder Stacey's Doomsday Warrior, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other thrilling titles in Graphic Audio.
This just in. A large fire is burning on the grounds of Arkham Asylum.
Allow me to introduce myself. I am called Enfer.
Reports are spreading through the city that various inmates have been spotted in nearby neighborhoods.
Honey, I'm home!
I came to make sure you answer for those firefighters.
Justice, Batman, is not the same thing to all people.
Graphic Audio presents DC Comics Batman Inferno.
Oh my, this will be good.
Batman just ran over that girl!
Three Gotham City police officers are confirmed dead. A full-scale manhunt is underway to find Batman and bring him in.
Lay him down! Slow and step away! Do it, Batman!
I'm not going to freeze while Gotham burns.
Arch-arsonist Enfer is apparently making good on his threat to spread havoc across Gotham City.
My city, my love. Who could live anywhere else?
Batman and all related names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics. Copyright 2009, DC Comics.
Serrano Legacy, Book 7, Against the Odds, Part 1, in Graphic Audio.
What?
Hands on your head. Don't move.
What's going on?
I have orders to separate you from the regular space service as of today.
I haven't done anything wrong.
Fleet has no place for your kind.
Squeezer, Esme, most recent rank 03, separated by order of Admiral Serrano? Grandmother, she double-crossed us.
Bad news.
What?
Peter Origamos, Consuline's foreign minister. Mother, killed him.
Miranda, you can't expect me to let it go.
Damn and blast, Cecilia. The man had my husband killed. He was a despicable, slimy...
Leave the Familius. I'll take you.
Haltbreach! Haltbreach! Report all starboard aft teams.
Sir, we've got a peak our chem scan doesn't identify. Something with a molecular weight of 16.
16? Lieutenant, didn't I tell you to look out for methane?
Emergency! We have a potentially explosive gas mix.
Sir... I'm scared. I can't just stand here.
Sure you can. Smartest thing you can do.
No! Don't leave me behind!
No! Don't!
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net. where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net.